With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Noise, the podcast series from PR Week. I'm Danny Rogers, the editor-in-chief of PR Week. Our normal co-host, Frankie Oliver, can't be with us today, unfortunately, so I'm afraid you're stuck with me this week. But I'm very excited because we're going to talk about buying and selling PR agencies, and also investing in PR agencies to build their value over the long term, which I know are subjects that many agency owners, of which there are probably more than 1,000 in the UK, will be extremely interested in. And I'm very pleased to welcome two experts on this subject. David Andrews, partner at private equity firm LDC. Hello, David.
Hi.
And also Jim Houghton, partner at marketing services advisory firm Waypoint. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Danny.
First of all, David and Jim, could you just tell us very briefly about yourself and your journey in agency M&A, starting with you, David?
Yeah, sure, of course. So LDC is the UK's largest private equity firm in the mid-market. We're part of Lloyds Banking Group and have been investing in UK-headquartered businesses for over 40 years. We invest across multiple sectors, and I've been part of the deal team in London for 12 years now and spent most of my career investing into media and technology businesses within that, with a particular interest in the PR space. So over the years, we've supported Blue Rubicon with their management buyout and subsequent sale to Teneo. We're currently supporting the growth agendas at Instinctive and more recently Headland, which is a business I led 2 years ago.
Mainly corporate agencies, financial agencies, or sometimes more consumer?
Less in PR, less than consumer. We're investing in digital marketing agencies that focus in more on the consumer space, but the kind of PR agencies we've supported in their growth journeys tended to be on the corporate, financial and public affairs side of things.
Very interesting. Thanks. Jim, how about yourself?
Yeah, well, you'll see there's a bit of overlap with David and myself in a second, but I have to confess that I started out in and around Omnicom. I started working with them as an advisor on their M&A strategy, which really kind of centered largely on European expansion in PR in the late 90s. I went and ran their M&A activity for them outside North America more widely for the best part of a decade. And for the last 15 years or so, I've been a M&A advisor to the marketing services industry around Europe, mainly in the UK. And I've advised We Are Social, Headland, hence a connection with David, Virgo Health, Lexington, Instinctive, Blue Rubicon twice. So I've seen a lot of organizations go through lots of different M&A journeys from different perspectives as a buyer and as an advisor over a long period of time. And it really excites me how M&A plays such an important role in growth over the long term.
Great. Well, some really good agency names there you've worked with, Jim. So let's set the scene a bit and talk about M&A activity in the PR agency world at the moment. Do we feel that M&A activity has accelerated this quarter, or is it about the same as it was last year?
Yeah, let me give you a sense of this first quarter. It's sort of difficult picking M&A trends out on a quarterly basis. Annual's quite difficult. Quarterly's hard. First quarter of any year tends to be probably the quietest quarter in terms of getting M&A deals done. Lots of M&A activities sort of driven off financial calendars, which tend to be natural annual calendars. So M&A activity tends to sort of get completed more during the second half of years rather than the first half. But it's been active. And I think saying it's and probably normal levels of activity I'm sure David will talk about the kind of general kind of macro trends and how that affects M&A a bit better than I can do. But it's sort of surprising how much activity there's been already in the first quarter, particularly in the PR space. And I think partly you can see that in terms of the robustness of corporate and public affairs in difficult, challenging economic and political times. Loyal clients with very, very difficult agendas that need kind of sensitive handling, and loyal clients that rely on that advice in a largely retained environment makes those businesses pretty resilient. So that's been a feature against a backdrop where perhaps some other elements of the marketing services world, digital comms, more consumer-faced businesses, it's been a slightly more challenging market just because most investors are thinking that the economic environment's going to make for a sort of slightly bumpier ride. And therefore, I think most buyers are interested in both sides of a transaction doing well from transactions. And companies that are having a more difficult trading environment, if you're a respectful, progressive buyer, you'll try and leave those companies to figure those things out for a while before you engage with them, rather than trying to take them through a process at a time that maybe doesn't suit them that well.
So you feel, in a nutshell, that corporate and financial is flying at the moment. Bit of uncertainty over the consumer digital space, possibly. Is that your thoughts, David?
As a financial buyer ourselves, we're seeing the market very soft at the moment. So it's been a quieter Q1 than we would expect to have. That's been a little bit of a trend over the last 6 to 12 months, largely driven by access to capital. So a lot of lenders are less active in the market at the moment in a world of increasing interest rates. I think some of the turmoil just in the macro environment at the moment, and especially over the last 2 weeks with Silicon Valley Bank and others increasing kind of pressures on the banking system, means that our feeling is that the slightly lower level of financial M&A will financial institution led M&A will continue in the short term, but we're positive about the second half of the year and beyond once some of those macro elements have stabilized a little bit more.
How do you feel about private equity's involvement in the PR industry generally? Has it become more positive over recent years? You know, we've seen a few investments by private equity in PR agencies.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. And you know, the potted history of private equity involvement in PR has its success stories and less so. I think, you know, it's an industry that often financial buyers struggle with because it's very people led. You know, your intellectual capital, your assets walk out of the door at the end of every day. But increasingly, people are understanding the value of the services that are provided by PR agencies and the criticality to the clients that they serve. And you know, we may come onto it. You know, in thinking about how you can help PR agency scale, you know, some of the benefits of private equity investment, you know, come into the fore, whether that's growing through M&A, doing bolt-on acquisitions of smaller agencies or acqui-hires to bring in skills and so forth, you know, expanding geographically into new markets, either through acquisition or with capital to seed the investment that is required to do that, or more broadly, you know, expanding services lines to be able to create a service offering that's more broad for your client base. All of those are very well trodden path for private equity, you know, and you know, in a world that is, you know, especially in the corporate and financial space, has a feature of kind of retained recurring revenues. That's something that private equity buyers really like because it gives you that kind of long term visibility of revenue and profit.
And how does that compare with, say, the advertising industry? Is it the same challenges that private equity faces in advertising as it does in PR?
I think there's similarities, but there's also, you know, substantial differences, and it's difficult to generalize in a short conversation like we're having today. But you know, I'm less, you know, close to the consumer PR world, and I think, you know, the kind of pushes and pulls of kind of macroeconomic and consumer sentiment kind of falls into that world and into advertising slightly faster than it perhaps hits into more B2B kind of PR around consumer and financial.
Very interesting. Is that your thoughts as well, Jim?
In my mind, when someone comes to me and says, I'm thinking about a next stage of growth of my business and maybe I should sell the agency to a holding company, or maybe I should raise money and kind of build the thing myself further, that's kind of broadly the way the conversations tend to split. If you look at the two growth accelerants that private equity brings to marketing or to public relations businesses. I think you've got two kinds of growth accelerant. One is just kind of better business confidence. And if you looked at that thread, Headland would be a brilliant example for me of private equity firm helping a management team be more confident, more relaxed, more certain in their future, creating more value within the existing team and just kind of going about, I don't want to call it business as usual because that sort of underplays the significance of it, but a kind of organic continued growth strategy, but more confidently and with kind of less risk attached to the individuals. So that there's that sort of strategy. I guess a more obvious, because it's in the press more, route that private equity fuels growth is in what is known as sort of buy and build type activity. And so accelerated at growth through further acquisitions. Really good examples of those in this space would be ICR in the US, which has grown at an incredible rate organically, but also has added multiple different business arms through acquisition in the years that since it's taken on private equity funding about 5 years ago, its first round, and did a second round a year or so ago. Penta also in the US, a Washington-based group that's private equity-backed, highly acquisitive, and completed a deal, might even have been yesterday. Farna out of Switzerland, which is a similar private equity backed, largely, I mean, great organic growth, but huge amounts of M&A activity. So they're two quite different sort of core strategies that investment can support in those businesses off the back of, I think the core investment hypothesis, and David, forgive me if this is oversimplifying, but when you look at PR companies, as distinct with most marketing businesses, there's just a degree of stickiness and loyalty around retained clients. And I think that's consumer as well as at the corporate and financial and public affairs end. But there's perhaps against retained clients, there's less retainer mix, perhaps for some of the consumer end of the spectrum, but still, I guess, not quite annuity revenues, but quite good predictability of cash flows that allows for confidence for financial investors. Whereas, you know, performance marketing agency will be much more spiky and seasonal, for example, and therefore a harder thing for an investor to get their head around.
Yeah, it strikes me that some of these corporate PR businesses who have had private equity investment have very much positioned themselves as trusted advisors, long-term trusted advisors to businesses, more like a sort of management consultancy model. Presumably the private equity quite likes that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, and the access to the C-suite within those businesses is a very important, you know, consideration. And then thinking about, well, again, you've got this access to and you know, position of trusted advisor. What are the other services that you can provide that enhances your opportunity to be providing the right advice to the client at the right time?
Okay, let's talk a bit more about the buyers of PR agencies. Who in recent months, who's been buying PR shops?
I think the big themes in which have driven acquisition, and most of these businesses who've been acquiring have been privately owned businesses rather than in the 90s and the noughties, the networks were the predominant buyers of PR agencies. Your growth largely around international expansion meant you just seek a new home in a bigger organization under your own brand and sort of continue under someone else's umbrella using their international infrastructure. And really, in the last decade or so, that's not been the majority of M&A activity. And what I've seen in recent months and recent years is sort of continuation of that same theme. I guess mini specialist groups have been really, really active. Businesses like Finn and Partners, Riddofin, maybe more specialist firms like PPHC. So you start to get into these sort of mini specialist, privately funded groups, sort of mid-scale, but very focused on a particular core offering and client type internationally, typically coming out of the US. Some of those groups have been these sort of private equity platforms that we've already talked about, businesses like ICR, and they've actually been between those two cohorts, probably the biggest individual group of buying activity in the last couple of years. And I'd expect that to continue, particularly the what's known as bolt-on acquisition. So a business like ICR that I described previously, that's been the dominant force for the last 12 months or so, and I'm sure it will be this year as well. And I think the characteristic of that kind of transaction that makes them really attractive is that kind of deal, you're typically not exiting your business. you're taking a financial de-risk as an entrepreneur. You're joining into a partnership with another organization that's got strategic ingredients that are important to you and valuable to your growth, international offices, access to new clients, talent capabilities, whatever that might be. But actually, you're probably swapping part of your own personal equity in the business you've been building for equity in someone else's. So there's a sort of, it's a more collaborative environment. It's completely the opposite of the model of the networks, the sort of standalone ring-fenced earnout type transaction where you're in a deal for about 3 or 4 years and it has a finite start date and it has an end date. Actually, in this kind of climate where growth is a little bit less predictable, the speed of it might be a bit faster or slower than you're expecting, the ability to ride out that unpredictability on someone else's equity, I think is really attractive. So that's mainly where we've seen it. The other area, maybe just to sort of close that off, the networks actually have been surprisingly active in the PR space. But the other big area that I see as a driving theme, and this takes you outside marketing businesses into the management consultancy world, is purpose as a theme. So I mean, probably the most acquisitive business in the consulting space recently in purpose has been the advisory arm of Capgemini Invent, that most recently acquired 23Red, had previously acquired Purpose Group. So you see businesses like that, that purpose is a theme and communication around purpose is so important that brings in a kind of different kind of commercial collaboration between.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Buyer and seller, and even specialist consultancies like ERM, that there's a pure play sustainability consultancy, have been buying communications agencies to broaden out their offering. And I really expect to see that theme continue this year and next.
I guess they're seen as growth markets, long-term growth markets, sustainability and purpose.
Yeah, a 30-year growth market, I would think at least.
And what about the Marcom? You talked about networks maybe not buying as many PR agencies at the moment. Does that also include the big Marcoms holding groups, the IPGs, the WPPs, the Omnicoms? Are they not buying as much, or is it just that PR agencies don't particularly want to sell to them?
Well, I think that's a fair way to end the question. I think that's probably part of it. I think there's been so much M&A in the PR space across the big holding companies over such a long period of time. And if you look at what they've been doing over the last 5+ years, it's mainly been streamlining, consolidating existing brands. And it would be pretty weird if you've just spent 5 years consolidating, take WPP as an example, crashing together. I'm sure they won't describe it as crashing, merging together multiple brands to come up with a BCW or these other sort of, you know, other kind of more aggregated brands they now have. A bit weird bolting on some others. And interesting looking at WPP's acquisition of the Goat agency, which I think finally got announced yesterday. Well, it's an influencer business. So perhaps it's on the fringes of what we're talking about today, but that's going into the media arm rather than going in as a sort of PR capability, which I think is an interesting play. But I think there's a reluctance and a tiredness around people selling businesses to networks. And as you said earlier on, Danny, a lot of them have kind of done it before. There are plenty of people who've kind of, or their peers will have done it before. And there's something a bit more exciting and a bit more innovative joining up with multifaceted, multidisciplinary, younger, emerging businesses with plenty of growth ahead of them that aren't beholden to quarterly earnings announcements.
You throw any light on this, David, from your investment background?
If you're kind of thinking about going into the next phase with your business, whether it's gone through private equity or is the next stepping stone, you know, think about your vision for the business. Does that align with the vision of the business that's looking to acquire? How do they fit together? Is there that ability to make 1+1=3 from, you know, synergies with clients, with geographies or whatever it may be? And who are the individuals that you're going to be reporting to and working with? Because you may be very used to working with no one that you report to, but all of a sudden you're going to be in a slightly different mindset and world. And equally, the buyer will have to buy into your vision for the business and how it fits. But it's important to understand, you know, from an agency side, you know, what you're getting into bed with, to make sure you don't, you know, have seller's remorse.
Well, extremely good advice, I'm sure. And have we noticed a change in the nature of the deals on that theme? You know, is the earnout still the same sort of length as it ever was? And what sort of multiples are going on, and what sort of percentages being taken in cash and so on? Any trends we're spotting in that area?
Why don't we talk about it slightly a neater and simpler answer from a private equity point of view? LDC is very flexible in how we invest. We can take minority positions and majority positions. When we're looking to partner with PR businesses, they tend to be minority deals. Again, that, you know, allows us to take a meaningful enough stake that we can generate a return for our institution, which is why we're in business, but still allows that the team to, you know, have majority ownership of their business and, you know, demonstrably be in control of their destiny. It is that true partnership model. That's not to say we wouldn't do majority deals, but we would always, you know, in any case, be expecting that, you know, the teams that we're backing are as bought into the future as they are the past. And by that we mean, yes, you know, part of doing a private equity deal is about taking some money off the table, you know, de-risking and getting value for the business you've bought to date. But it's also about making sure you've got as much of the upside to come as well. So we like to, you know, think of the way we structure deals as almost a 50-50. Take half of your value off the table today, but invest half, you know, into the business that we will support you scaling over the next phase.
Jim, from your perspective, has the nature of deals changed at all in recent months or years?
I think it has a little, and it kind of comes back to the point around who's doing the acquiring. You know, when I was back at Omnicom, it was perfectly logical with Omnicom's then approach to deals to say to people that you're going to join our organization. We don't want to run your company. We don't want to make you change offices, even adopt any of our systems apart from our treasury system. You'll have your own brand, your own culture, just kind of carry on. We hope we can accelerate it by creating opportunities for you, but the opportunities will be there for you to access. We won't push them onto you. In that world, an earnout that takes 3 or 4 years and it's a multiple of profits of the company over that period is a perfectly sensible way of doing it, because you're saying to people, it's going to take you a year or two to get to understand our system and what your opportunities are. And we want to give you a couple of years to actually go and generate some value out of those opportunities. So that kind of structure sort of suits. And most repeat buyers are very careful not to allow their multiples to move up and down too much with the markets in the short term. Because all those entrepreneurs that you've collected as part of your CEO club through 4, 5, 10, 12 years will end up meeting each other at drinks parties. And if someone sold to you at a 6 multiple and someone sold to you at a 10 multiple, there's going to be an unpleasant phone call on the Friday morning, you know, when they've come in from the drinks on the Thursday night. So they're very careful with that.
I started this conversation by asking whether most PR agencies look to sell ultimately. From your extensive experience, is a sale the objective for most agency founders?
Honestly, I think probably yes. But equally, I don't think that should be problematic for anyone. I think as Brits, we are ridiculously coy about things like this. If we were having this conversation in America, I'm not actually sure it would be at all a controversial question to sort of pose to either of us. If we were having it in China, it would be uncontroversial as well, although selling businesses there is still kind of culturally less kind of commonplace. But it's just a very peculiar British thing. I think there shouldn't be any stigma around that, as long as it's part of a structured growth plan that has fair value allocation to everyone who's creating value. I don't see any problem in that. And I don't know many buyers, David, who've got a problem with that either.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, people don't live forever. People don't work forever. So at some point, you know, a founder of a business needs to think about what the next stage for them is individually. One thing private equity can help with is that succession planning, becoming that bridge between the next event. And you can do multiple rounds of private equity where private equity houses sell themselves, sell businesses that they're invested in to other institutional investors. And that point of, you know, businesses will sustain, but what is the ultimate, you know, end goal of that of that business? And, you know, yes, if the end goal for a business isn't to sell to someone else, that means either you're finding a way to wind it down or you're living forever, which you can do, but you need to become one of the businesses that is acquiring other businesses or sustaining itself, going public, or but that still is a form of sale in itself anyway. So yes, we shouldn't be, you know, ashamed of that.
No, it's a peculiarly British thing, I think, as Jim pointed out. I mean, it's really about building value over time and then realizing that value in some way. And I suppose it, as you say, Jim, it's about an equitable realization of that value, right? So it's ensuring that all the people, or a lot of the people who were central in building that value, also get realize some of it.
But I think there's a nuance to the sector as well. That, you know, you've got a difference in ownership models and business models within the sector as well. You know, traditional partnerships can sustain themselves. You look at the large consulting groups; they've never, you know, sold themselves to anyone. They've just been partnerships that have scaled over time. And, you know, some of the larger PR businesses in the UK and globally still operate in that model. Others have gone down different routes where putting large stakes or kind of proportions of the shareholding into employee benefit trusts. So the employees become
EOT.
EOTs. Exactly. So that can be a route to, you know, an exit of sorts, but transitioning, you know, value in the business to employees or to, you know, in a private equity example, the next tier of management that are coming up behind the founders.
I was going to throw in one anecdote to try and sort of bring the point to life a little bit. And it's an oldish one now, and it's in the research space rather than PR. But back at Omnicom, Mike Hall, who'd been the founder of Hall & Partners, came in the very first meeting he had with us. And when I was at Omnicom in the M&A team, myself and the global chief exec of that division of the business, we'd never met him before, didn't know of him really. It was a interesting business, but it wasn't particularly big. And he sat in front of us around a big round table, slid a document across the table to us and said, explain the business a little bit, and explained that he'd spent the last 10 years building the business to sell to us. Specifically, he'd created it to sell it to us. He'd been following us. He knew exactly what we needed. We were very light on research as an organization. He'd picked the market opportunity absolutely perfectly. He'd framed it in our words. He described our opportunity. And he explained that on the day that we completed the deal, he would no longer be the chief exec. This was the chief exec who'd be replacing him, who was already in the business doing this role. And his role would be to move into building research products that we would syndicate globally using our platform. And it was a completely sort of taboo, irreverent way of running one of those meetings in Britain anyway. But as a global organization and with a US listing, when someone comes in into you and approaches it that way, which says, here's your business opportunity, I've thought about it, I've demonstrably thought about it, and I've quantified the business benefits for all of us. Here's a structured plan over a period of time that creates value for everybody. I mean, it might be taboo, but what's not to like about that? And we got that transaction very happily completed very quickly because it was so well thought through, and it had been thought through from the start to work for us. I wouldn't recommend, by the way, to anyone that you set up your company specifically with one acquirer in mind. That's a very high stakes game to play, but, you know, well done, Mike. You called it exactly right.
Speaking their language, I guess. So here's an interesting question for you, David. What are the most important things for LDC when deciding to invest in a comms agency?
It's a very simple one. It's the team. It's the people. So, you know, we back management teams. We don't back sector trends. We don't back businesses. They come secondary to our investment, the kind of thesis. And it comes back to my point on, you know, ambition and behind that capability. So, you know, do the individuals that you're meeting, you know, in those early meetings, you know, are able to demonstrate why the business exists, you know, what value they bring to their clients and what the opportunity for further growth is. You know, it's our job then to look at that and think, okay, well, we can get behind that plan, and we can think of ways we can help supplement that and you know, in our small way, provide input and guidance around the board. But it begins and ends with management.
Anything to add to that, Jim?
You never sell a company ever in any discipline based on its financials. It just doesn't happen. And I think that's a really common sort of misconception of M&A. But deals cannot happen because of financials. And if you're a holding company that's targeting, I don't know, 15% margin, you can't be buying businesses that are making 12% margin, unfortunately. So, I mean, there are some sort of financial de minimis that will apply in strategic M&A at all too.
Great. So, David, how does an agency best prepare itself for a sale?
So I think it starts fundamentally with understanding what you want out of a transaction, you know, and that can, you know, conversations with people like Jim can certainly help with that. But fundamentally, are you looking to sell your business? You know, is it about, well, you know, finding the end home for the business and whatever the financial, you know, tie-ins that come with that may go? Or is it, you know, you have a strong belief in the future, you have a vision for the business, but you want a supportive partner to come on board? So I think I'd recommend, you know, your listeners start there thinking about you know, what it is and what the vision is. And then it's about forming the articulation of that vision, which is, you know, what are the building blocks for growth? What are the areas that we're looking for support in? Which is why, you know, we want an external party to come alongside us.
Extremely useful advice. Anything to add to that, Jim?
One comment that I think is really important, and again, statistically unprovable, maybe unreliable, but I think about a third of our clients probably haven't even had time to plan. Inbound approaches are quite often the trigger of an M&A process. Someone's just kind of, you're a great agency, you're doing something exciting with a particular client, and a deal just sort of happens to you. So you don't actually have time to plan. But assuming in the other two thirds of cases, you do have time to plan. The other thing, I think really important point, and I wouldn't alter any of the prioritization that David's talked about, is when that planning happens. People who come and see us and I'd like to sell the business, I'd like to exit the business in the next 12 months. Well, that's good. We should have been talking a year ago then, or 2 years ago. The timing of when to start planning, you know, a business plan that isn't just window dressing, you can get in front of an investor like David and you can probably blag your way first through the first two meetings with some, you know, window dressing and some nice financials and some good awards to have in the showcase. But if you haven't got a proper plan that's got proof points against it, that shows momentum against a plan, you're probably not going to survive the entire M&A process. So getting your internal team aligned around a plan, proving that you're capable of delivering it and proving that more than just the founding team are bought into it.
Thank you. That's the end of today's podcast. I want to thank Jim from Waypoint and David from LDC for your great advice and all your time. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Beyond the Noise. We've got the PR Week Top 150 coming up, of course, in May. So agency valuations and sales will be very much top of the agenda again. But in the meantime, please continue to listen to our pods. And we look forward to you joining us next time. Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.